Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Studying philosophy can be a metaphorical journey into wisdom. My guest today experienced it not only as that, but as a very literal journey as well. His name is Eric Weiner, and he traveled thousands of miles around the world to visit the haunts of numerous philosophers as he sought to better understand their insights and how he might apply them to his own life. He wrote about this philosophical pilgrimage in the Socrates Express, in search of life lessons from dead philosophers. Eric and I began our conversation with why he chose to take all his trips by train and why rail travel is particularly conducive to thoughtful reflection. We then turned to the philosophical and physical stops he made on his journey, including why Marcus Aurelius wrote so much about getting out of bed and what ultimately motivated the emperor to start each day, what Thoreau can teach us about seeing, why Gandhi was very interested in the idea of manliness, how Nietzsche's idea of eternal recurrence can change the way we live our daily lives, and the lesson Simone Beauvoir offers us on aging well. We end our conversation with Montaigne's insight on how to get comfortable with death. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/Socrates Express. All right, Eric Weiner, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Brett. Happy to be back with you.
So we had you on a few years ago to talk about your book, The Geography of Genius, where you go to explore these clusters of genius around the world that have happened out in human history. You got a new book out, similar sort of thing. You go this time to places where philosophers lived, walked, worked, thought, but you get there by train. Mm-hmm. It's called The Socrates Express. What was the impetus behind this book?
Well, first of all, I love trains. So let's get that out of the way right off the bat. I'm not a train nerd, as some people are who really get excited about tonnage ratings and locomotive types. I'm not that kind of train lover. I love the experience of riding trains, of just slowing down. I feel like I can think on a train the way I cannot think on an airplane or a bus or even driving a car. So that was my means of transport. In terms of the subject matter, you know, I think I got to chalk this one up to middle age, you know, which I know sounds a bit cliched, but it's true. You start to wonder, what's it all about? What am I doing here? And then I stumbled across this quote from a French philosopher named Maurice Riesling, and he said, "Sooner or later, life makes philosophers of us all." And I thought, why wait? You know, why wait until life becomes a problem for me? It wasn't at the time. And then that sent me on the journey of exploring philosophy. And after I tucked away the book and sent it off to my publisher, the pandemic hit, and life surely made philosophers of all of us.
That's for sure. I want to go back to this idea of trains and this connection to philosophy, because you note this in the book, and I've seen this with when I've read different philosophers. A lot of philosophers didn't like trains because they're too fast.
Right.
Of course, this was in the 19th century.
Right.
But I mean, what is it about? I mean, you said you think better on a train compared to driving. Like, what do you think trains for you are conducive to philosophizing?
Well, you're absolutely right about some philosophers not liking trains. A lot of people in the 19th century, when train travel really became widespread, didn't like trains because they complained they were too fast, right? They got all nostalgic for the carriage and the horse and buggy when you can go more slowly and feel the land. And they felt like the trains moving at 15, 20 miles an hour back then were just, the scenery was a blur and it was all too fast. So, I mean, that shows us how relative these things are. But compared to, you know, hurtling through space in a tin can at 600 miles per hour, I like the slowness of a train. I find it easier to think when I'm moving more slowly. And I like sort of this, especially, you know, those European trains where you get your own compartment or compartment you share with some strangers. And you get this combination of coziness and expansiveness at the same time, which I just find wonderful. And I just feel like I could just ride a train forever with a stack of books and a cup of coffee, and I'm good to go.
Do you get by train in the United States?
I do. I took a train clear across the U.S. from my home, Washington, D.C. to Portland, Oregon. Took 4 days and 3 nights, and it's not, okay, the fastest way to cross the country. It's not the cheapest way, but in my mind, it's the best way. So whenever I can, I take a train.
So let's talk about the way you organize this book. So it's organized into 3 parts, dawn, noon, dusk. Am I reading into too much of this, but does this also fall like the seasons of a person's life, like youth, middle age, elderhood?
You are absolutely not reading too much into it. That was my intention exactly. It is course of our life. And in the Dawn section, you know, there are questions that as we're growing up, there that skills that we need to learn, like how to see and how to listen, how to walk, that we learn at that age. And then when we're sort of in mid-stride of our lives, you know, we want to fight, we want to be kind, want to do all these other things. And then there are certain questions that we really grapple with in the twilight of our life, you know, how to have no regrets, how to cope with setbacks, how to grow old, and even how to die.
And it was the type of philosophers that you picked in this book, they're not like analytic philosophers or they're trying to,
right.
These are philosophers like the original intent of philosophy is like how to live a good life.
Mm-hmm. I mean, philosopher means literally from the ancient Greek, a lover of wisdom. Doesn't say anything about PhD dissertations or analytical thinking or logic chopping, as it's been called. Lovers of wisdom. And I love that because I think that's what we should all aspire to be lovers of wisdom. You know, I'm holding a device in my hand right now called an iPhone that contains, you know, pretty much all of human knowledge and just so much information, but not really any wisdom. And there is a difference. You know, we tend to conflate them, you know, data, information, knowledge, wisdom. You know, information is readily accessible these days, as I said, with the swipe of our finger. But wisdom is something else. You know, wisdom is of a different kind. And that's what these philosophers were interested in.
Well, let's pay a visit to some of these philosophers you highlight in the book.
Sure.
And the one you start off with is Marcus Aurelius, the famous Roman emperor, one of the last good emperors. And he was also a Stoic philosopher. And you noted this, and I've never noted this because I've read the Meditations, his sort of personal diary that he wrote, sort of pumping himself up but we have it today. Right. But I didn't know, but you noticed this, is that he always talked about getting out of bed. He talks a lot about getting out of bed.
Yeah.
What do you think is going on there?
Well, I think just because you're a Roman emperor doesn't mean it's easy to get out of bed. You know, I mean, and I found this very relatable. I thought, you know, here's this guy who is, as you say, one of the last good Roman emperors, you know, controlled like, you know, 2/5 of the world population. Yet he had trouble falling asleep at night and trouble getting out of bed in the morning. And he would sort of wrestle with it on the pages of Meditations. You know, should I get up? I'm lazy. You're good for nothing. Why should I get up? And it just seemed very modern to me and very relatable, as I said. It's my story too. I have trouble getting out of bed in the morning. And, you know, the French philosopher Albert Camus said that the only truly serious philosophical question is whether you should commit suicide or not. And that's okay. We can talk about that later. But I thought, well, yeah, once you've answered that one and you decide not to commit suicide, you still have to get out of bed. And that's the one that Marcus wrestles with. And what I find interesting is how he ultimately answers it, which is not, you know, I'm going to go achieve something and make my name in the history books. It was the sense of duty, the sense of other people, that I should get out of bed for others because people in this empire are counting on me. And you know, if you're at home with the wife and kids and sometimes, or dog, you know, this is what gets you out of bed. The dog needs to be fed. Kids need to be driven to school. And Marcus had a similar revelation.
And you also use this question of, should I get out of bed in the morning, to explore the idea of is and ought. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So this was an idea from a Scottish philosopher named David Hume. And he thought that, you know, we can't jump from an is to an ought. In other words, we can't jump from a factual observation, empirical observation, to an ethical imperative. So with the case of getting out of bed, you would say, well, it is a good idea to get out of bed because, you know, you get exercise and your earning potential increases. Therefore, you ought to get out of bed. He thought that was a mistake. And this is why it's sometimes known as Hume's guillotine, because he severs the is from the ought. So, you know, oftentimes we just will make observations about something in the world, anything, you know, that red wine is good for you or red wine is bad for you. Therefore, you ought to drink it or you ought not to drink it. And he thought that was a mistake. You can't jump from the is to the ought.
And Marcus Aurelius, I mean, he kind of solved that problem. He's like, well, I'm not going to say getting out of bed is good or bad. It's just like, I just got to get out of bed because I have to. Like, it's a duty. That's it.
Yeah, it was a sense of duty to others. And even though, as you know, you've read meditation, so you know it can be a lot of navel gazing going on there, definitely, because, you know, it was his diary. So we were actually eavesdropping on him. He didn't mean to publish it. But in addition to the navel gazing, is this sense of duty, you know, which was a Stoic thing and a Roman thing. But he got out of his own head, realizing there were others counting on him. And this duty really wasn't just as, oh, I'm a Roman emperor, I have to get out of bed and help people. It was his duty as a human being, you know, and this is where his stoicism becomes readily apparent. His duty as a human being to help others, because the Stoics see us all as connected. You know, if you smash your thumb with a hammer, you help the thumb because it's connected to the rest of the hand and the rest to you. And that's how he thought. And it's a Stoic idea, really. That's how we should relate to others, not as separate entities from us, but as extensions of us.
So we can't talk about philosophy without talking about Socrates. Sort of like we consider him the father of philosophy. And what's interesting about Socrates is that he didn't have a Socratic doctrine, right? If you read it, even if you read his dialogues, you know, he starts off asking these questions like, what is justice? And then you spend pages and pages.
Right.
And at the end, you're like, I still don't know what justice is, or even what Socrates. But yeah. Socrates, instead, he proposed like a way of engaging with the world. And so how would you describe this Socratic engagement?
Yeah, it's not a body of knowledge, as you say. You can't really read what Socrates thought. All you can do is experience and observe his method. And it is, as you say, engagement. It is a way of just engaging in conversation. I mean, I know that doesn't sound highfalutin and Nobel Prize worthy, but that's what Socrates did. You know, one contemporary philosopher says he engaged in enlightened kibitzing, which is a great term, which is, I think, is what he did. He would buttonhole people in Athens, you know, a general, for instance, some fancy general, and ask him what courage is. And it soon became readily apparent that the general didn't really know. How could a general in an army not know what courage is? How can an artist not know what beauty is? And so he would challenge people, but he did it in this sneaky way, in that he would just sort of start to engage them in conversation and ask questions. And every question was followed by another. It's sort of like the, you know, the five-year-old who always says, why, you know, can we have ice cream now? No. Why? Because it's 10 a.m. Why can't we have ice cream at 10 a.m.? Because we don't. Why? And it drives us nuts. And it drives us nuts, just as Socrates drove people in ancient Athens nuts, not because the questions are silly, but because we can't really answer them fully.
Right. Yeah. Like you call these like ultimate questions, and we tend to avoid those because we don't have any good answers for them.
Or we tend not to really sit with questions. You know, we see a question as kind of an inconvenience, a little shortcut on the way to an answer, right? Questions must lead to answers. And Socrates basically said, whoa, you know, let's hold on here a second. Let's experience this question fully and see where it takes us. And we're so results oriented these days, as they were back then, to be honest, that we always want to get to the answer. And Socrates thought, you can't get there unless you really sit with the question, experience it. And that means questioning your assumptions. What do you mean by courage? What do you mean by justice? You know, we just jump ahead to, okay, we need to increase earning potential for people. Well, why? Why is that good? And it's almost a childlike process, this childlike curiosity, and more than curiosity, wonder. All philosophy begins with wonder. We have largely, I think, lost this capacity for wonder in our lives.
And like you said, Socrates is basically, we call it dialogue, but it's just conversation. And I think we've all experienced those late night talks with friends where you're just asking questions and just sort of spitballing, and you don't ever really come to any conclusions, but you felt invigorated, edified by being in that conversation.
Yeah, because you've experienced the questions and you've asked them in ways that you wouldn't in the classroom or in the corporate board meeting, you know, because you might be laughed at. But Socrates basically gives us permission to be a five-year-old and ask those annoying, silly questions.
And you apply this to your own life. You talk about it. You were kind of complaining to a friend that, you know, I wish I was more successful, sold more books, whatever. Right. And then your friend just asked you, like, what does success look like to you?
Right.
And you didn't really have an answer for that.
No, I didn't. And it's kind of floored me, you know, that I had just always assumed that I needed to be more successful. However successful I was, I needed more. And she said, what does success look like? And the way she phrased it that just stopped me in my tracks. Like, I don't know. I don't know what would be enough. I don't know what it would look like. Maybe it looks entirely differently from what I thought. And, you know, a really good question is met not with an answer, but with silence. You know you've asked a good question when the person on the other end is quiet. That means that you've shaken them out of their stupor, as Socrates did, and they're starting to see things a little bit differently. Not 90 degrees, maybe 10 or 20 degrees, but sometimes that's all it takes.
Have you gotten any closer to answer to what does success look like to you?
No, I'm still working on that, but I'm wide open to the possibility that it's not what I think it is. And whenever I find myself, you know, thinking, well, I need to be on the Colbert show. I need this. I need that. And I stop and my friend's question comes back to me. What does success look like? And it's helpful. But the problem with these great questions is you have to keep asking them over and over again. Once is not enough.
No, that's a good advice. I've had that moment where you're doing something. Finally, you just stop. And you're like, why am I doing this?
Right.
And then you just like, maybe I don't need to be doing this.
Exactly.
And that's helpful. All right. So the next place you go is you visit Rousseau's, Jean-Jacques Rousseau's old tramping grounds. And I say tramping because this guy apparently was a walker. What'd you take away from visiting where Rousseau walked?
Well, he was a walker. He was a nomad. He was sort of this sort of rootless soul. You know, we're talking back in the 18th century when it really wasn't so easy to be a rootless soul, but he bopped all over Europe, often kicked out of places. And his favorite way to get around, this is pre-railroad time, was by walking. And he would walk sometimes 20 miles a day. He walked some 200-300 miles once in the course of 2 weeks. And he would go off on these walks, usually in the countryside, and he'd carry a pack of playing cards with him, and he would jot down ideas and thoughts that came to him when he walked. And he said that his mind only works when his legs are active. And I thought there was great truth to that.
And like lots of other philosophers were walkers. Like Socrates in his dialogues, typically he goes on walks with people when he's engaging with them. Nietzsche was a walker as well.
Yeah, Socrates is walking around the Agora, the marketplace of ancient Athens. Nietzsche is hiking in the Swiss Alps. Immanuel Kant, who is very rigorous and disciplined, would go on these constitutionals at 12:45 p.m. exactly every day. So they all had different styles, but they all walked. And I think, you know, it's not a coincidence. Maybe you've experienced this yourself when you're stuck on a problem or you're looking for some answer and you can't think of it and you're sitting at your laptop and you're like, F it, I'm just going to go for a walk. And you go for a walk, maybe for 10 minutes, maybe for an hour, maybe for 2 hours. But something happens during that walk where the idea comes to you and you become unstuck. Psychologists call this defocused attention, right? So we have defocused our attention. We're no longer staring at the problem, but we've defocused it and moved it back to our subconscious. But then by walking, you know, we're still engaging the brain. You know, you're not just vegging out when you're walking. You have to think about, you know, not tripping and watch where you're going. So you have just enough of that part of the brain engaged, but the rest of it's freed up.
I mean, what was your takeaway from Rousseau? Like, walk more? I mean, what was...
He was a philosopher of the heart. He was a romantic, one of the first, really. And it is walk more, but it's... God, it sounds corny and cliche to say it, but follow your heart. You know, be willing to be a rebel. Be willing to walk when everyone else is running and driving. And, you know, listen to that thing beating in your chest. And, you know, he thought that people, I'll sum up his philosophy in four words, nature good, society bad. That's essentially it. And what's more natural than walking, right? So he thought basically that we are born naturally good people and it's only society that corrupts us. So, you know, there is something to be said of that. There's a reason we like to go for walks in the woods. There's a reason why we feel at peace when we're off in the forest or on a mountaintop. And that's certainly one of the lessons of Rousseau.
And I guess this is why you included in that dawn section, like for the youth of our life, right? You need to, every young person needs to figure out what they really want. Are they doing something because your parents told them so to do it, teachers told them to do it, or are they really following what's inside of them?
Right. And children just do this naturally, right? They tend to just follow their instincts and emotions move through them quickly. Maybe you've seen like a 4-year-old or 3-year-old, they'll be so angry, you know, and they're just crying. And then a minute later, they're okay, it's gone. And they're happy, you know. And Rousseau, who thought a lot about education, actually would say that that's because they have not yet been corrupted by society and they let their emotions flow through them unencumbered. They don't get stuck with guilt and remorse and all these other adult emotions. So yeah, there was something very childlike about Rousseau, and that's another reason I included him in the dawn section.
I mean, there's also, you got to balance it, because Rousseau, he kind of let his proclivities get, like, he'd just like show his butt to, he'd moon people, basically.
Yeah, he did. I don't think the term mooning people existed in the 18th right. century, but he was doing it, and he had a masochistic streak. He liked a good spanking. I mean, I think, you know, Brett, this would be a good place to point this out, that these were some weird dudes and dudettes here, okay, and that my philosophers were, you know, I liked them because they were deeply flawed human beings, you know. I mean, Socrates was weird. Rousseau moon people. Nietzsche, don't get me started. I mean, they were all, you know, we think of the philosopher as this almost angelic figure who's just sitting by himself thinking deep thoughts. And no, these people wrestled with how to get out of bed, you know, how to stay out of trouble, all kinds of stuff.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a thoroughly modern design. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing, and the interior is built with robust materials and integrity. The Defender capability is legendary, whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions. The Defender 110 lets you go further and do more. It's built for the modern explorer. They've got lots of cargo space, so you've got plenty of room for your gear. They also have powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system that keeps you connected, and they have an innovative camera technology system that delivers unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. It is ready for a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. A vehicle made to go further, the Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. There are millions of workers, but there's only one you, with only one body. So why wear it down with lesser power tools? You deserve ease, you deserve safety, you deserve Bosch. With Bosch tools, you can raise the X-Lock, hammer drill, or 2-in-1 with pride and know that you deserve it. Now lower it, safety first. Bosch tools, what hard workers deserve. Did you know Fast-Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the United States? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Fast-Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. So I got a tree from Fast-Growing Trees. I had a tree in my front yard that I had to cut down, a big giant oak tree, because it died, and I wanted to put a maple tree there, one that turned bright red during the fall. So I found that tree, made sure that it fit the climate that we're at here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Ordered it. A few days later, I got the tree in a box. It's crazy they can send a tree in a box. And I planted it. A few weeks after I planted it, it's already starting to sprout leaves. So I think in a few years, I'm going to have that bright red maple tree that happens in the fall. I'm really looking forward to that. So if you want to try Fast Growing Trees out, this spring they have the best deals online, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off with their first purchase when using code manliness at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using code manliness at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code manliness. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. And now back to the show.
So an American kindred spirit of Rousseau, I think would be Henry David Thoreau.
Right.
He's a romantic as well. And you go visit Walden Pond, where Thoreau did his experiment in self-reliance. And it's like, I've always wanted to go to Walden Pond, but I'm afraid that if I'm going to go, I'm going to be underwhelmed by it. Did that happen to you?
Yes. I was underwhelmed before I arrived when I followed the Walden Pond State, it's now a state park, on Twitter, and they would send me alerts, you know, by 10 a.m. saying, Walden Pond is full today, no more entry, you know, from visitors. And, you know, the irony here that this great exercise in isolation, you know, Thoreau goes off to Walden Pond, builds a cabin, lives there for a couple of years, is now overcrowded and a tourist destination. I mean, Henry David would come back and be like, no, that's not what I had in mind. It is underwhelming. It's a pond. It's a nice pond. Nothing special about it. You can see the cabin is gone. They've reconstructed a sort of a scale model, but the site of the cabin is now just some stones and a marker. But people go there. It's a pilgrimage site. And you know, I've talked to locals who feel basically like, you don't need to come here. Go find your own Walden. That's the whole point.
So besides being underwhelmed, what was your big takeaway from Henry David?
Yeah. So I go off to Walden Pond thinking, for sure this chapter is going to be called, you know, how to be alone like Thoreau, or maybe how to live simply like Thoreau. But being open-minded like Socrates, I soon realized that wasn't really what he was about. It was how to see like Thoreau. That all of this, you know, living alone in the woods, this isolation and simplicity stuff, was really a means to an end. And that end was better vision. He was very visual. Everyone commented about his eyes, that he had these piercing eyes, very observant eyes, and that he could, in this almost uncanny ability to like pick up a dozen pencils out of a giant bushel, exactly a dozen each time by sight alone. So he had this almost supernatural vision, but really he had a whole sensibility that was attuned to seeing more beauty in the everyday than most of us do. He saw beauty everywhere.
What I like about Henry David Thoreau is he's a romantic. He's kind of a mystic too. I mean, because there's these stories where, you know, he just, you know, stoop down, pick up an arrowhead that he just happened to find and said, this arrowhead belonged to some great native chief.
Right.
But then at the same time, you go back to this idea of seeing, he was very scientific. I think there was a story of, you know, there's a legend that Walden Pond was endless. There was no bottom. And so Henry David waited till the pond froze over and he got a plumb line and then just dropped it down. And you go, no, it's actually not. It's not bottomless. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, I love that story of just like he really spent his life trying to see what the world was really like.
Yeah. And the thing is, he had this combination of skill sets, I guess we'd say, that we rarely see today, and that he had the mind of a scientist, but the heart of a poet. And we don't see that very often. And you're right. He very much believed in empirical evidence, the power of observation. He was a naturalist and a scientist, and he studied the pond and he made observations. But he was not interested in what is known as the view from nowhere, which is the scientist's view. You know, this idea of objectivity, that we're observing the rainbow, we're not, you know, appreciating it necessarily, that somehow seeing the beauty of a rainbow is not a scientific act, but observing the and measuring the color hues is. Thoreau thought that was a mistake. He thought that we're always seeing things subjectively, even when we're being scientific about it, that we're, you know, we're part of the experiment. And so he never separated that his mind from his heart, essentially.
So related to seeing is the idea of paying attention. And you highlight a philosopher that thought a lot about paying attention. A lot of people don't know about her either. Her name is Simone Weil. For those who aren't familiar with Weil, can you tell us about her and her philosophy?
Okay, also a strange person. And I say that in the best sense of the word. She grew up in France, the early 20th century, born in 1909, I believe. And she born to a very intellectual, very Jewish but secular family. And she studied like the Dickens when she was young. I mean, she was reading the classics like by age 8 and that sort of genius level. But she had a very spiritual side, which she spent the rest of her too short life exploring. And she was especially interested in attention, the quality of attention. And it really is the thread throughout her writing that she thought that we define attention entirely wrong and that we don't go about it the right way, that we confuse attention and concentration and they're not the same thing.
What's the difference between the two?
Well, if you are you sitting at a desk right now or?
I'm actually standing in my closet, which is my / recording studio.
Okay. See, I didn't see that coming. All right. But you are maybe concentrating. If you were at your desk and at your laptop, you are concentrating on the emails in front of you. You're concentrating on a problem. And you'll notice when you're concentrating, your body sort of tenses up. This idea of furrowed brow and tensed muscles, and you sort of contract really when you concentrate. But when you pay attention in the Simone Weil way, it is more receptive. It's more of a waiting than a concentrating. You sort of widen your antennae and you are in a receptive mode and you're waiting for something to come to you. And that she thought was true attention. And it's less muscular. It's, I would say, more yoga, less weightlifting. But she thought it was hugely important. And she thought it was I want to say skill, but really it's an orientation to life and to the world that we've largely lost.
And she kind of, the way she described attention, it's a moral act in a way. It's not just about seeing what's going on in your world. It's actually, there's moral weight to paying attention.
Right. And we tend to view things like attention as just transactional, like so many other things, that you should pay attention so that you will get better grades in your school so that you will then earn more money. So pay attention. She thought that paying attention, especially paying attention to the suffering of others, was a moral act. And she thought that that's really, that's all that the suffering person wants. Really what they want is someone to give them full attention. And when you do that, she said, it's not like an act of love. It is an act of love, giving another person your complete attention.
I think and it's not just suffering people. It's like I think everyone wants attention. Like they just want to, everyone wants, has this desire to feel noticed.
Right. And you know, these days we've really fractured our attention, you know, more than ever. And you know, I'm constantly getting into, fights, we would say, with my wife when she picks up her phone when we're in mid-conversation. And it really pisses me off. Like, why are you checking your phone? You're supposed to be talking to me. And it's not that, you know, the 2 seconds that it takes her to check her email or whatever it is, she has a real job. It's that she's cheated me of her complete attention, right? And children know this. They can detect counterfeit attention a mile away.
Now, that chapter made me think about how I pay attention to my kids and it convicted me. It's like, I probably could do a better job at that.
Right. But you probably should not think of it as a job.
Yeah, I know. I'm a modern instrumentalist.
Then it becomes this sort of concentration thing. I have to do this. And yeah, we are never fully paying attention to something, anything. We're always divided. We're never fully committed. And Simone Weil saw attention as actually more of a passive mode. And passive, you know, tends to have negative connotations. I think, especially maybe for a podcast called The Art of Manliness, we might think of passive as negative. But she didn't see it that way, that actually the highest thing you could do was to have this passive attention. And it actually took great courage and great devotion to do it.
So another philosopher you talk about. You go to India, and I like this story because I've heard stories about the crazy train system in India. But you go to India to explore Gandhi and his philosophy, and you had this quest to get on the yoga train. What was that?
Yoga Express.
So what's the Yoga Express? Why were you so gung ho and trying to get on this?
Oh, come on, it's called the Yoga Express. You've got to. I don't do actual yoga, right? I don't bend that way, but I wanted to ride the Yoga Express because I thought that would be cool. And it was going to where I wanted to go, which was the site of Gandhi's first ashram in India, the city of Ahmedabad in the state of Gujarat. And, many hundreds of miles from where I was at the moment in New Delhi. And I'm like, I have to get on the Yoga Express. And I contorted myself in all kinds of positions to get on the Yoga Express. But well, I won't spoil it, but it proved to be more difficult than you would think to get a reservation on the Yoga Express.
And how was that experience related to, or maybe, was there a relation to Gandhi's philosophy at all?
Yes, there is. Because if you've ever dealt with an Indian bureaucracy, could be the train system, could be anything really, you know that there's a strong impulse toward violence because it is so difficult to get anything done in that country. And they seem to just throw up obstacles every way. And it's a test of patience and a test of resolve. And Gandhi was a big train rider. He loved the train. He took the train all over India. And he complained a lot about, he rode in third class, but he complained a lot just about the service and about Indian railways. And he was infuriated, but never got violent. But it's sort of a test of how do you get what you want, a ticket on the Yoga Express. You can't just be passive, but how do you get it without resorting to violence?
Well, let's talk about Gandhi's philosophy. He has this idea of soul force, and he had this idea, it's nonviolent, but it's also, it's not passive. Like it's an aggressive type of nonviolence.
It's what John Lewis was talking about when he talked about good trouble, necessary trouble. That's pure Gandhi. And Lewis studied Gandhi and traveled to India, as did Martin Luther King Jr. I mean, it is getting in your opponent's face, but getting in their face nonviolently. It's not passive. Gandhi disliked the term passive resistance. He thought there was nothing more active than his form of nonviolent resistance. But it involves confronting your opponent. I won't say enemy because he didn't believe in enemies. He believed in opponents. Confronting your opponent, but doing it nonviolently.
And when Gandhi talked about this idea of, I'll call it aggressive nonviolence, he spoke of it in terms of manliness. Like he used that word, like he was obsessed with manliness.
The more I've studied Gandhi for a long time, I have sort of a weird Gandhi thing. I've long admired him. And as I read him, I discovered that the word manliness just appears a lot. And you're right, most people don't think of Gandhi as a manly man. He was skinny, but wiry and muscular. And he was assertive. And he wrote a lot about the need for manliness. He felt that the British who were occupying India had emasculated India. And it was his job to remasculate, if that's a word, India, but in a new way, in this nonviolent way. And he, as much as he hated violence, he wrote that the only thing he hated more than violence was cowardice. And he actually said, better to resort to violence than to be a coward.
And I guess in Gandhi's worldview, like conflict is not bad because conflict is what allows problems to be, brings to the forefront. Like you finally can see that there's a problem there. And then from there, you can actually find a solution to the problem.
Exactly. I mean, maybe you know couples who over the years say, we never fight. And then when they announce their divorce, you're not really surprised. I mean, you are and you aren't, because fighting can be healthy. And, Gandhi thought basically, even if you're not fighting, there's kind of veiled violence going on beneath the surface, and that needs to be brought to the surface and dealt with nonviolently. But yes, that was what he thought.
All right, let's talk about Nietzsche. You go to the Alps because Nietzsche had to go there because he was a sickly guy. This is one of the things about Nietzsche, like, he wrote this very manly, muscular prose about living dangerously, but he was a sickly, I don't know, a nerd, basically.
He was.
He had to go to the Alps to recuperate. And you go on this hike that Nietzsche went on to where he got this idea of eternal recurrence. For those who aren't familiar with eternal recurrence, can you walk us through it?
Okay. So here's the idea. It's a thought experiment, really. One day you're visited by or say you get an email. They didn't have email in Nietzsche's day, but you get an email saying, here's the secret to the universe. Your life repeats itself exactly forever and ever. Everything in Brett's life that's happened up to this point will repeat itself, including a conversation with me saying everything in Brett's life up to this point will repeat itself. That'll repeat also. And it will do this forever and ever for all eternity. And then Nietzsche's question is, how do you respond to this email? Do you say the recipient is just, oh, thank you for telling me this. This is great news. Or do you see it as a curse? This is like, you know, worse than a Nigerian telemarketing scam or whatever. This is just terrible. You know, this is terrible news. And he thought how we answered that question determined our outlook on life and our degree of happiness, really.
And so the idea of eternal recurrence is to make you live each day like, well, if I have to repeat this for the rest of my life, what is
worthy of eternity? And I should say briefly that he tried to sketch it out mathematically, and he did a bunch of research, which he never actually published, looking into, you know, the idea that, you know, like if you take two people playing chess, maybe eventually they'll repeat every game exactly. So there is some scientific basis for it, but it's essentially a thought experiment, and it forces you to ask the question, what is worthy of eternity? And if you're not living the life you want to live, not only this time around, but forever and ever, maybe you should make a change.
But then also it helps you, I mean, it kind of forces you to confront, like, what do you do with the suffering? Because Nietzsche would say, well, you just got to learn to love it or else you'll just be miserable. So he'd say, embrace suffering.
Yeah, but he didn't say it with such a resigned tone of voice, to be honest. he said it with lots of exclamation points. He loved the exclamation point. He talked about the need to dance. You know, he was not a good dancer, but he sort of dances across the page, and he thought we need to dance. And dancing, if you think about it, is this kind of nonsensical thing we do where we move around sort of to the beat of music, kind of not. It's not productive. And there are all kinds of dances. There are funeral dances in many cultures when there's great grief and sadness. And that's essentially Nietzsche's philosophy. It's the dance of grief. It's the dance of suffering. It's even, you know, it's easy to dance when the music's good and everything's going well. But what Nietzsche asks is, can you dance even when things are lousy? Can you find a way to dance? And a sort of variation of eternal recurrence is what's been called the marriage test. And let's say you're recently divorced after a long marriage, ended poorly, obviously, in divorce. Would you do it again? Would you, knowing what you know, would you do it again? Would you marry that person and go through that marriage and go through the divorce? And then that's essentially what eternal recurrence is.
You know, when you're talking about dancing to suffering when bad things happen, that made me think of Zorba the Greek, the end.
Right.
The movie where the timber operation just crashes and then they dance at the end.
Exactly. And that's sort of, it's not resignation, actually. It's something else. And I'm not quite there myself, but I definitely think Nietzsche was onto something because he suffered. He, as you said, he was sickly, had terrible headaches and stomach upset and terrible vision. And yet he accepted it all and made it, he accepted his life, not despite the suffering, but in a way because of it.
So you go and visit where a 20th century existential philosopher hung out, Simone Beauvoir. And her seminal work is The Second Sex, which is about the female experience. But she also wrote about the universal experience of aging, getting old. And this section hit home for me because I'm starting to approach 40. And you know, I don't feel old, but every now and then I look in the mirror and think, man, I'm getting really old.
Yeah, she had that experience. She was 51 and she looked in the mirror and she saw this stranger staring back at her. And she's like, oh my God, when did I become old? And then she went for a walk in the street and some woman came up to her and said, you know, you remind me of my mother. And that was it. You know, so that's when she had her, I call it the collision with old age, that we don't brush up against old age or sideswipe it. We collide head on with it.
And like, how did she manage it? What did she suggest we do to deal with that?
Well, I should say that anyone who knows anything about Simone de Beauvoir will say, really? You chose her for aging? Because she was on the page very pessimistic about it. She wrote this long tome, 500-page tome called The Coming of Age, which basically most of it was old age sucks, you know, and there's nothing redeeming to it. But if you read it carefully and you look at her life, you realize that she actually did age well. She was aged reluctantly, you know, at first. She fought it every step of the way. But she sort of came up with, she didn't come up with the list, but I inferred the list from her writing of things you can do to age well. And I should say that we don't have a culture of aging in our country. We have a youth culture and an aging population desperately clinging to the youth culture. And she thought this was a mistake. You know, if you're going to be old, act your age, essentially. In other words, don't try to imitate a 20-year-old. That's just silly and absurd. And she thought it was hugely important to stay busy and continue with your projects. That was her favorite word. To make friends late into life. She made one of her best friends ever. Sylvie Lebon was her name. 30 years separated them, but they were the best of friends. And really, in a way, stop caring what other people think. Simone de Beauvoir observes that some of the greatest artists really had a breakthrough late in life. After they'd achieved some success, they were able to go off in a completely different direction because they didn't care what others thought. So she actually ended up aging quite well and came to embrace it late in life.
And have you been able to, I don't know, live some of the stuff that she recommended?
So, I would say. You know, I'm a little bit older than you, and I'm at the stage where I'm engaged in what I call the great summing up, which is essentially you start to look back at your life and you look for a narrative, you look for a thread to sort of make sense of it. And this can be an act that can make you depressed or it can actually be uplifting. And I think for most of us, it's more uplifting because we start to see this narrative arc. I mean, really, we're creating the arc in our mind, but never mind. It's there. I once met a composer of classical music in Iceland who was older than me. And looking back, he said, well, I met everyone I needed to meet when I needed to meet them. And I think Simone de Beauvoir would agree that with that too. You start to see that things happened for a reason. I'm not saying that everything is fated, but all the pieces start to fit together.
So the last philosopher you visit is Montaigne. And he famously wrote these essays just about everything. Could be about food, sex, but then he also wrote a lot about dying. And he famously said, philosophy is learning how to die.
Yeah, he changed that by the end of the essays to philosophy is learning how to live and dying is just part of it. But he wrestled with death and dying throughout his life and on the page. I should say that he lived in a time, even though it was the 16th century in France, that's not that different from ours in that there was a plague, bubonic plague in Bordeaux, where he was actually mayor. And he did what a lot of people did. He escaped. His family owned a vineyard out in the countryside, and he went there, went up to his tower, wrote his essays, in fact, invented the form of essays, and thought a lot about death and dying. And he thought about it mostly intellectually until one day he was out riding. He was a real equestrian. He loved riding, and some jerk on a big horse knocked him down and just, you know, flattened him. And he thought he was dying. I mean, he was coughing up globs of blood, and he thought that was it. He had what today we'd call a near-death experience and changed his attitude toward death and dying. And he realized how, well, he said it wasn't death that he was afraid of, but dying, the process. And that's probably true for most of us. He realized that it is part of a natural process. You know, and the Greek philosopher Epicurus says, well, you didn't think about that you were nothing before you were born. That never bothers you. So why should it bother you that you'll be nothing after you die? And Montaigne wrestles with that. And ultimately, he concludes that, you know, we just don't know, but nature knows best, that nature has your back. He says, don't, you're afraid of dying, don't worry. Nature's got you covered.
Yeah, he says, you already know, you'll know what to do when it's time, right. when it's time to happen.
You'll know what to do. And you think about childbirth. I mean, women gave birth successfully, not always successfully, but, you know, obviously we've propagated the species for many centuries before modern medicine came along. And, you know, there's a healing process in nature. If you break your bone, it will heal. And he just thought that we should not look at death as something out there. There's me and then there's death. Where part, you know, you start to die the day you're born, and that's not something that necessarily needs to make you depressed. It's just part of nature.
Has that helped you at all? Does thinking about dying?
Again, I have to give the so-so answer. a lot of this is easier in theory than in practice. But I liked Montaigne. I liked how he, you know, he was sort of like me in that he took a little bit from here and there. He read all the philosophers, and ultimately his saying was, "What do I know?" You know, he had that sort of questioning what he really knew. And he was just very relatable, I thought. And yeah, I mean, I keep going back to what he wrote about death and dying. And, you know, it still freaks me out, the idea of nothingness, I have to be honest. But I do find not just comfort in his words, but wisdom.
And for those who want to dabble in philosophy, Montaigne's it's a fun read. I would consider, like, he was like the first blogger, because he just write about whatever.
There you go. He wrote about thumbs. He wrote about cannibals. He wrote about his penis. He wrote about food. And then he wrote about death and dying and religion and all these serious topics too. And they were very personal. And they, as you read them, they become increasingly personal, and you find that he's hitting his stride.
Well, Eric, where can people go to learn more about the book and your work?
Well, I have a website, ericweinerbooks.com, Weiner, W-E-I-N-E-R, all one word, or on Twitter, Eric_Weiner, again, W-E-I-N-E-R.
Well, Eric, this has been a great conversation. Thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Brett. I really enjoyed it.
My guest today was Eric Weiner. He's the author of the book, Socrates Express. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can find out more information about his book and his work at his website, ericweinerbooks.com. Also, check out our show notes at aom.is/Socrates Express, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM Podcast. Check out our website at artofmanliness.com, where you can find our podcast archives, as well as thousands of articles we've written over the years. And if you'd like to enjoy ad-free episodes of the AOM Podcast, you can do so on Stitcher Premium. Head over to stitcherpremium.com, sign up, use code manliness at checkout for a free month trial. Once you're signed up, download the Stitcher app on Android or iOS, and you start enjoying ad-free episodes of the AOM Podcast. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. It helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member you think we get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay, reminding you not only to listen to the AOM Podcast, but put what you've heard into action.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.